You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, May 19th, 2010, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening to you all.
Jay is in Arizona. Probably on a plane, actually. So
yeah, en route.
En route, so not accessible.
No.
He's going to personally take on all of the pseudoscience in Arizona by himself.
With magical vortices and other happenings happening out there.
Hey, maybe we should say right now that if you're listening to this on Saturday, May 22nd, Jay will be at the Skeptics in the Pub at the Rock Bottom Brewery and Restaurant. That's at 14205 South 50th Street. And if you need to call, it's 480-598-1300. So go and see Jay. There's already about 37 people that have already confirmed to be there, so it sounds like a lot of fun.
Whoa. He'll be signing autographs and doing shots.
Evan, what is important about today?
Well, do you know what happened 100 years ago today? What year was it 100 years ago?
It was 1910.
When the Earth passed.
That took way too long, everyone.
The Earth passed through.
Yeah. I mean, I have an excuse. It's midnight.
The Earth passed through the tail of Halley's Comet.
Ah.
The
right.
Most intimate contact between the Earth and any comet in recorded history.
Yes.
I don't want to talk
sexy.
About it.
Yeah, right. Because then 76 years later, we got the worst view of Halley's Comet in several thousand years.
I still have nightmares about that.
And in 1910, they had the best view. Yeah.
Nightmares.
Well, I'm exaggerating.
The worst astronomical anticlimax ever.
Yes. I'll put it that way. That's a better way to put it.
But compare it to this. Would you rather have been around in 1910 when astronomers had realized that there was a poisonous gas inside the comet's tail and you're about to pass through it? Like, how would you feel about that being in that time?
I would think that humans have lived through it many times before, so why would that be any different?
Bob would have started a podcast and debunked the hell out of it.
Right. So how much panic was there actually at the time?
Well, I don't know.
That's the story, but I wonder how much panic there really was.
Do you want to hear what Carl Sagan had to say about it?
Sure.
All right.
By 1910, Halley's Comet returned once more. But this time, astronomers using a new tool, the spectroscope, had discovered cyanogen gas in the tail of a comet. Now, cyanogen is a poison. The Earth was to pass through this poisonous tail. The fact that the gas was astonishingly, fabulously thin reassured almost nobody. So, for example, take a look at the headlines in the Los Angeles Examiner for May 9th, 1910. Say, has that comet cyanogened you yet? Entire human race due for free gaseous bath. Expect hijinks. Or take this from the San Francisco Chronicle, May 15th, 1910. Comet comes and husband reforms. Comet party is now fad in New York. Amazing stuff.
There's a little taste.
Yeah, but it sounds like they weren't taking it too seriously. Right?
Not too seriously, but there were some people taking advantage of the otherwise uninformed public by selling pills and gas masks and other things to profit off of this event.
And then there's the T-shirts, I survived Halley's Comet 1910.
Yeah. And all I got was this T-shirt. Yeah.
Right. Evan, see, I thought you were going to go for 30 years ago yesterday being May 18th.
Oh, you know what? I didn't even check May 18th. I only checked the 19th, and I thought that was...
Guys, know what happened 30 years ago yesterday?
No.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Mount St. Helens.
Mount St. Helens. Very good.
Yeah, that's right. Ah.
Kablooey.
I remember that. Boom. That was pretty wicked.
Yeah. Well, let's go on to some news items. First one is a brief update on the whole cell phone cancer hubbub. We've covered this topic a little before. The question is, does radiation from cell phones, which many people will hold up to their head while talking into them for minutes or hours a day, does it increase the risk of brain tumors? And there have been a number of epidemiological studies. Up until now, The bottom line has been that for short duration, meaning less than 10 years, in adults, the evidence was basically negative. So no association with short term, you know, less than 10 years of exposure. For greater than 10 years, it was equivocal. The epidemiology wasn't clear. And for kids, still equivocal. We didn't really have enough data. There is, however, an ongoing, fairly massive database involving 13 countries gathering data on cell phone use and brain tumors, specifically glioma and meningioma. And there have been some published reports out of this data, but this is now just published. Is the first time that evidence from all 13 countries has been brought together. And what they found doesn't really change the status quo very much. They found essentially overall there wasn't much of a risk associated with it. In fact, for the average user, there was a 20% decrease in risk of tumors. Now, no one thinks that cell phones protect against brain cancer. This is probably just an anomaly in the epidemiology. They speculate that people who do not use cell phones were less likely to agree to be in the control group, right? So you get a phone call from some guy saying, you know, can you be in a study about cell phones? And you don't use one, you may say no. And therefore, the control group had fewer cell phone users than would be in the general population. Therefore, it would make it look as if there was a protective effect to using cell phones, right? Because there would be more cell phone users in the no brain tumor group. So that probably explains that. And then in the group that used the cell phone the most, however, there was a 40% increased association with these two types of brain tumors. However, the data was a little bit quirky. They asked people, like, how many hours a day do you use a cell phone? And in the top 10%, there were a lot of answers that didn't make any sense, like 12 hours a day. That's, you know, that seems a little heroic. You know, I mean, that's a lot of cell phone use.
Unless they asked a lot of teenage girls or something. Or...
It's even still, it's hard to imagine somebody has the phone up to their head for 12 hours a day.
Teenagers just text now anyway.
Right. So they decided to look at the data again, but this time focusing on the question, how many phone calls do you make a day, as opposed to how many hours a day do you spend on the phone? And when they took out the top 10% of phone users by number of phone calls, the association went away. So it didn't hold up when they looked at the data that way. So it seems like it's probably a statistical fluke. It didn't really hold up when they re-examined the data. And the bottom line is that this overall adds to the evidence against a link between cell phones and brain cancer, and also extends the period of observation a bit. You know, before we really couldn't say anything for greater than 10 years of use. This gives us some data up to 15 years. So now we have to say we don't really have data for greater than 15 years, but for less than 15 years, it's probably negative. And this also was in adults, so it doesn't really help us with kids, which is still a bit of an open question. So still equivocal. We have to also consider the fact that the plausibility is quite low. Not zero. You know, I would say it's low, but not zero. Cell phones don't put out a lot of radiation. It's not ionizing radiation. It's just electromagnetic radiation, and the energy is pretty weak. So there's not a lot of plausibility that it would be a mutagen or that it would increase the risk of cancer. But biological systems are complex. Something physical is happening. And even though we can't explain it with known mechanisms, it's not impossible because, you know, it's not like homeopathy. Something is actually happening. Yeah.
Hey, Steve, you know what this reminds me of? I recall in the days when microwaves you know, were becoming popular in the 70s and certainly by the 80s, they were in every home. And about, you know, maybe 10 years into it or so, you know, they were questioning, you know, are there any harmful effects from eating so much microwave food? What does microwaving your food do to you? Right, and I think it turned out, you know, as they looked at it more and as the data increased, they obviously found out that, you know, there's no harms that they can detect from microwave food. I think we're kind of at that stage of the cell phone experience.
Yeah, I agree. Perhaps. There seems to be hysteria and fear-mongering around any new technology, just at baseline. Right, there was, remember the high-tension wires, you know, living under, you know, overhead high voltage wires. That was a scare for a while. And leukemia, that was in the 80s, maybe into the 90s. That was then disproven. I think these things crop up every now and then. So I'm not concerned. I think if you are concerned, you know, there's still the sort of basic recommendations of, you know, switch sides and limit your cell phone use if you want to. And, you know, I always have to say that the devices for shielding your head from the radiation don't work. They either don't shield you from the radiation, or to the extent that they do work, they actually block your phone's signal. So, you know, there's no way to protect or shield yourself from the radiation without interfering with its functioning. So those are a waste of money.
My favorite newspaper here, the Daily Mail, I had already seen this study printed up in a number of different articles, and then I went to the Daily Mail's website, and pretty much all of the articles I read, the headline was something along the lines of cell phone cancer link inconclusive, or no brain cancer link to mobile phone use. But the Daily Mail's was, long conversations on mobile phones can increase risk of cancer.
Right, for 12 hours.
Good job, Daily Mail.
Yeah.
Wow.
12 hours.
It should have said really long.
Really long. I found the same thing, Rebecca.
Maybe.
A lot of inconclusive sort of conclusions, and then a few headlines saying that there is a link. You know, so this was the kind of study where you could basically pull out of it whatever you wanted to if you were going to cherry pick. But put it into context, it's actually, I think, overall reassuring. We're left with the bottom line that there either is no risk or it's really small. Because if it were bigger, you know, we would be able to pick it up easier with these kind of studies. I said you're probably at more risk from your cell phone for talking on your cell phone while driving.
Yeah.
And then you increase risk of cancer. Well, Bob, you're going to tell us why we exist.
Yeah, this is a tricky one. Well, actually, this was an interesting news item, and it got more interesting the more I dug into it. Now, we all take matter for granted, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's a matter of fact. No doubt about it.
Matter of fact. We've never really known a time without. It's nice to have around. It'd be pretty boring without it, right?
Yeah.
But in fact, you know, why matter even exists is actually one of the biggest mysteries in physics. Now, this is because our best scientific theories tell us that as soon after the Big Bang, that there were equal amounts of matter and antimatter in the early universe. And since antimatter is identical to matter, except for that pesky little opposite charge, when they come in contact with each other, you have this titanic release of energy, right?
Right.
So therefore, matter and antimatter, really, they should have totally wiped each other out. Why is the universe then mostly matter? So, you know, why isn't the universe just a void filled with some energy flying around and nothing else? No stars, no planets, no life, and most importantly, no Reese's peanut butter cups.
Right.
So physicists at the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory recently reported that they may have found a new clue that could help us resolve this mystery using the second biggest collider in the world, the Tevatron.
That's the second biggest collider I've ever seen.
Yes. Used to be the first biggest.
The third biggest is in Iron Man's basement. Fact.
Yeah, right. That's a nice little collider you put together. So at the Tevatron, they studied a fascinating particle called neutral B mesons. Now, remember that particle. I think you're going to be hearing about that in the future. If you're, you know, follow these things, these particles are special because they actually spontaneously switch between a matter particle and an antimatter particle trillions of times every second in the so-called flavor oscillation effect that they go through. I've heard of particles oscillating, like the neutrinos that solved the solar neutrino problem, the neutrinos en route from the sun. The idea is that they actually change between the various flavors of neutrino. But these particles are a little different. They're switching between particle and antiparticle trillions of times every second. That was pretty fascinating. So what's going on, though, is that when these particles decay, they can produce one of two things. They produce either a muon, which is a kind of like an obese electron. It's just like an electron in that it's a fundamental particle. It's got a negative charge, but it's 200 times as massive. So this thing is a lot bigger, a lot more massive than just a regular old electron. And then the other thing that these mesons can produce when they decay is an anti-muon. So the cool thing is that this decay produces more matter than antimatter. You would think that half the time it would decay into matter, and the other half of the time it would decay into antimatter, but it's not. There's a slight bias for matter. Now, we've seen biases like this before. You may have heard the so-called CP violations, charge parity violations, You may have heard of that. Those are other ways in which you could have a little bit more matter created than antimatter, but it's a really super tiny effect, and our theories predicted that anyway. But this new data suggests that 50 times more matter is made than the standard model of particle interactions says that there should be. So this is the really interesting part. Research team representative Stefan Soldner-Rembold, he said that many of us felt goosebumps when we saw the result. We knew we were seeing something beyond what we have seen before and beyond what current theories can explain. So for me, that's the rub right there. This might be a signpost to new physics, something beyond the standard model, something that scientists have been looking for decades, really. You know, who knows what we may find if this is true? It could be an entirely unknown particle, never right. before seen. It could be new types of particle interactions. And the LHC is, I think, is primed to really dig deeper into this.
My understanding, Bob, was that as these neutral beta mesons, as they're oscillating back and forth between matter and antimatter, they're in the matter state a little bit longer than the antimatter state.
Right. Yeah,
It takes longer to go from matter to antimatter than from antimatter to matter. So there's about this 1% excess time they'll be spending as matter. And then
right,
that's where you get the extra matter when they...
neutral B mesons. I'm not actually... Does a B stand for beta? They're calling...
Neutral B mesons.
So yeah, that's it. They're, for some reason, they're hanging out in, you know, in that state, in the matter state, in the regular, you know, ordinary matter state, a little bit longer than the antimatter state when they...
So that's what they got to figure out. Why does that happen?
Right.
Yeah.
Hopefully this just isn't some error that, you know, some decimal point or some problem that they had.
Yeah.
And all other, you know, when they try to replicate it, hopefully it won't shrink down to what the theory predicts it would be. So hopefully this is a true phenomenon that they could actually now just really try to figure out using the LHC, I guess, would be probably one of the best ways to do it.
Right. But talk about the anthropic principle. You think about this. If it wasn't for this one tiny exotic... you know, feature of this one particle, the universe would be just energy and would have no matter in it.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. This one tiny little thing. And there's lots of similar ones, but this would be a new way to look at it. But another way to look at it, Steve, is that, you know, at the birth of the universe, there was this huge amount of matter and antimatter, and we're just the tiny little spark that's left over.
Yeah, a residue. Yeah.
Yeah, this tiny little residue that's left over from this titanic, you know, conversion of matter and antimatter into energy, into, you know, gamma rays and neutrinos and stuff. And we're just this tiny little thing that's left, and that's the whole visible universe right there.
Yep.
Is that like waste product or?
Yeah. Well, look at that.
Quick plug for our friends down under. Richard Sargis and his colleagues made a YouTube video on applied kinesiology, how it's done. If you look up that name, you'll find it. And essentially, they go over the notion that applied kinesiology is pure pseudoscience. It's basically a trick where you have somebody either hold up their arm or try to maintain their balance, or you know, see how far they can rotate at the hip, and then you give them the magic treatment, whatever it is you're testing for. You could do this with to see, for example, if you're allergic to a substance by holding it in one hand, or you can hold the alleged treatment to see if it makes it better. And then, you know, when they the next time they push down your arms, you'll be able to resist better and hold up stronger. It's pure ideomotor effect and suggestion. And whenever tested in a blinded fashion, it doesn't work at all because it's complete BS.
But Steve, that doesn't stop chiropractors from implementing applied kinesiology in their diagnosis of patients. 12.9% of chiropractic patients are being treated with this.
Yeah, I mean, chiropractors, you know, mix in a lot of these kinds of things, right? These kind of pseudosciences into what they do. So, but if you want to learn more about it, go to Applied Kinesiology, How It's Done on YouTube, and Richard Saunders and Rachel Dunlop and friends will tell you all about it. Well, we're going to go from applied kinesiology to another one of my favorite pseudosciences, homeopathy. The British Medical Association recently came out with a statement about homeopathy. This is my favorite quote in the last couple of weeks. The BMA announced that homeopathy is witchcraft. That was their summary. They say, if people want to pay for homeopathy, that's their choice, but it shouldn't be paid for on the NHS until there is evidence that it works.
Awesome.
Witchcraft.
So this was this. The quote was specifically from Tom Dolphin, deputy chairman of the BMA's Junior Doctors Committee, and he said, "Homeopathy is witchcraft. It is a disgrace that nestling between the National Hospital for Neurology and Great Ormond Street in London, there is a National Hospital for Homeopathy, which is paid for by the NHS."
Burn.
More well-deserved beating up on homeopathy. Now, in the UK, there are actually 4 homeopathic hospitals. Can you imagine an entire hospital dedicated to pure nonsense?
Wow.
Yeah, and that's the guy who runs that hospital was the one that was in a lot of the meetings with Parliament that Ben Goldacre was at, fighting over whether or not Boots should sell homeopathy.
Yeah.
I mean, really? Doctors send people to these hospitals?
Homeopathic doctors do.
Yeah, or they're just self-referred, I guess. The only survey I saw in this country, in the United States, said that about 5% of physicians use homeopathy, which is a disgrace. You know, but I think 5% of physicians are total quacks, basically.
Yeah, it's one end of the bell curve. Hey, also, by the way, I think this is an insult to witchcraft, ultimately, because actually, you know, they're actually adding Eye of Newt and Toad's Tongue, right? Not some... you know, molecule of it. They're actually adding these things.
So yeah, you get real stuff.
That's a good point.
So,
right. So let's yeah, we apologize to all you witches out there. Well, let's go on. There's a lot of news items. We're going to try to burn through a few here. There was a recent news item looking at the aerodynamics of early bird feathers. Now, the earliest birds, such as Archaeopteryx and Confucius Sornis, have feathers that look like modern flight feathers, but it really wasn't known for sure if, say, Archaeopteryx was able to fly. If it did, it was a very bad flyer, or if it used these feathers for something else. So what some researchers did is they essentially just computer modeled the feathers of the Archaeopteryx and the Confucius Sornis, and they found that they would not have been strong enough to support those animals in full flapping flight. So neither of those early birds were able to fly by their measurements. So Archaeopteryx lived around 145 million years ago in the late Jurassic, Confucius Sornis around 120 million years ago, so it's a little bit later than the Archaeopteryx, and it does look a little bit more modern than Archaeopteryx. It doesn't have teeth, for example, or Archaeopteryx still does. But they're both at the base of the bird tree, if you will. So there are other possible uses for feathers. Display is one. It could be purely for display or for insulation. But if it were purely for insulation, you would expect the feathers to be more downy and have less of like a rigid shaft and a modern feather-type structure. But they might have early on been for insulation.
For gliding.
And then the other one is for gliding, right. So based upon this new analysis, it seems like these two birds, the Archaeopteryx and Confucius Sornis, may have glided from tree to tree, or they may have climbed up to a high perch and then glided down from there. That could have been a way to ambush prey. You know, you just sort of hang out above them, and then when you see them run beneath you, you glide down and attack them like a bird would, but you just couldn't have flown up in the first place. You had to climb up and then glide down.
Right.
Very interesting, and also, of course, flies in the face of the, you know, irreducible complexity nonsense from the intelligent design buffoons.
Or it doesn't fly in the face, depending on right. how you look at it.
Yeah, because yeah, they again they say like, what's the use of a half a wing, or what's the use of a feather until you get to the point where you're flying? Well, you know, here we have a clear cut examples of animals that had almost modern looking feathers that, you know, were right on the fence. I mean, they probably couldn't fly based upon this analysis, but they were using their feathers for something. So this, you know, again supports the notion that feathers evolved for one thing and then were co-opted to another function and maybe co-opted again, you know, for another function until they got to the point where they could be used for full flapping flight. Maybe started out as downy insulation, then for display, then for gliding, and then for flying. You know, that's the pathway that it might have taken.
Yeah. They said, Steve, that these shafts, even if they were solid, they still wouldn't be able to support the weight.
But just something that occurred to me, is it even feasible that maybe these shafts were solid and they were also just denser or maybe stronger than they think they could have been? And then maybe they could have supported full flight of sorts because of that fact.
I'm not sure how much they are certain about the internal structure of these feathers from the fossils that we have, but they're probably assuming that they're no stronger than modern feathers.
Yeah,
which is probably
more
a reasonable
likely.
Assumption.
Yeah.
Yeah. Rebecca, I understand you're a fan of ball lightning.
You didn't have to put it like that.
That's what you told me.
Oh, how about testicle lightning?
Oh, God.
Put it like that.
Oh, Evan.
Oh, someone's got a fill-in for Jay.
I love ball lightning, yes. Well, you know, I've always liked a good ghost story. And when I was a kid, I think ball lightning was kind of one of those creepy ghost-like stories that could be true. You know, something, you know, during a lightning storm, which is already scary enough, maybe there's a creepy floating ball of electricity that could melt through your window and then skitter across your floor and zap you and kill you. So I always had a weird fascination with it. And I was always a little disappointed that in all the hundreds of lightning storms I've seen, I never got a chance to see ball lightning. So yeah, there's an interesting news story about it recently that Evan found, actually, much to my delight. Previously, you know, scientists have tried to figure out what ball lightning is. It's remarkably common, really, considering how weird it is, but something like 5% of Americans claim to have seen ball lightning. And so something is happening, but scientists haven't been able to pin down exactly what it is. And they've been unable to really study it in the wild, so to speak. There have been some laboratory tests that have dealt with creating ball lightning. For instance, you can create something that looks like ball lightning in your microwave. That's a ball of plasma. So there have been, you know, certain tests like that happening in labs, but nobody's been able to figure out if what they're creating in labs is actually what's being witnessed in the environment. So this recent news story, it's physicists who are claiming that there's a possibility that ball lightning might actually be a magnetically induced hallucination, which is quite remarkable to think about. They say that transcranial magnetic stimulation, or TMS, isn't that what they say for, like, when you have a jaw problem? No,
it's,
that's TMJ.
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 Syndrome.
Transcendental meditation.
It's actually, as an aside, TMJ stands for temporomandibular joint. But I often hear people say, I have TMJ, you know, to which I respond, I hope you have two. What they really mean is I have TMJ syndrome, which means, you know, arthritis of the TMJ. But go on.
Fascinating.
Fascinating.
So, yes, TMS is a technique that scientists have used to study the brain by generating magnetic currents into very specific parts of the brain in order to see what happens.
And I might add that the magnetic pulses are oscillating at specific frequencies, and those frequencies determine whether or not the TMS will either increase or decrease brain activity. So it has to actually be fairly fine-tuned. It's not just random frequencies. Right.
Right.
Which is important, which is why I'm pointing it out.
Right. What these physicists are claiming is that if you focus the TMS on the visual cortex, that it can make the subject see lights that are like discs or lines. And if you move it to, if you move the field within the cortex, then the subject will actually see those lights move around, which pretty closely describes what people see with ball lightning. So when you consider that lightning strikes can actually, affect the brain in a similar way if you're very close to the strike, something like within 200 meters, then under very specific circumstances, it could cause that phenomenon. Now, again, it's the sort of thing that's going to be extraordinarily difficult to field test. You would have to, I don't know, stand a group of subjects out in a field with a bunch of monitors hooked up to their brains, I imagine. But it is it's an interesting concept. Now, there have been reports in the past of ball lightning actually killing people, so it doesn't really quite solve that problem. So right. I think that, you know, there's a possibility that some ball lightning, some accounts of ball lightning might be due to this sort of magnetic stimulation in the brain, while others might be the sorts of plasma balls and electrical energy that they've been playing with in labs. Because, you know, if you look at the accounts, they don't all exactly match up. There are some that describe a ball floating high in the air and far away. If you go on YouTube and search for ball lightning, you'll see flickers of like balls of lightning way off in the distance in the clouds. People have described them coming, you know, like skittering across the floor. So it's tough to say. We might be dealing with several different kinds of phenomena, but this is one more theory to add to the pile.
Yeah, although I don't buy it. I don't find it very compelling. Because and this is why I mentioned the frequency thing. What they're saying is if you get a repeated lightning strike, right, that the lightning sort of hitting the same spot over and over again in rapid succession, that can cause the rapidly changing fields similar to what is used in transcranial magnetic stimulation. But it would have to be in a pretty narrow frequency range.
Yeah. And they describe it, that type of lightning, as happening 1 to 5% of strikes.
Yeah.
And if you consider that 5% of Americans claim to have seen the ball lightning, that doesn't quite add up.
Not only would it have to be that kind of a strike, it would have to be within a certain frequency range, and the person experiencing it would have to be within a certain range and not get killed in the process.
Right.
It's a little contrived. I think the only thing they really added is to say, yes, it's powerful enough to, you know, that the magnetic field generated by the lightning strikes are powerful enough to create magnetic fields as strong as what are used in TMS. That's really the only thing that they added. The rest is pure speculation and seems a little far-fetched to me.
Yeah, that's why I'm thinking, if anything, this might account for a small percentage of ball lightning reports.
Which means that we still need some other explanation for them, and
I hold out hope that ball lightning is real and is some awesome true ghost story, and it will come into your house and kill you.
Yeah,
if it gets the chance.
Well, finding one for the $1 million challenge. If they predict ball lightning and
I don't know, maybe
have a theory for it, and then it comes true. That'd be interesting.
Maybe, and I should go into one of the main theories just really quickly, which is that basically small particles are held together in a ball by electrical charges, and that emits chemical energy through oxidation. The theory says that when lightning strikes a surface, it forms a vapor, and that condenses into particles that mix with oxygen in the air, and then those slowly burn with the release of chemical energy. And I think that's one of the leading theories of what happens with ball lightning.
I would buy that more easily. It's an interesting little mystery that maybe we'll solve someday.
The authors of this article missed a perfect opportunity to use in the headline, "Scientists Shocked This Discovery."
You're right. They missed that opportunity.
Yeah, they missed
they
that.
They really missed that.
They should have consulted.
Why don't you send them a letter? Yeah. You should be on standby.
Dear uncreative scientists.
There has been another recent study in the news recently, and this is one that we've gotten many, many emails about, so I thought I would talk about it briefly. I did blog about it today on Neurologica. The apparent association between certain pesticides and ADHD. So this was in the journal Pediatrics, actually a very nice study. I think the study itself is fairly rigorous, but it's an observational epidemiological study looking at children in a database where they had urine tests for different metabolites of pesticides, specifically organophosphates. It's one type of pesticide. And then they did a phone interview of the parents and used a standard questionnaire to diagnose them, the children, as either having ADHD or not. And then they just said, is there a correlation here? Or do kids with higher metabolites of organophosphates in their urine more likely to meet the criteria for the diagnosis of ADHD? Now, they tested six different metabolites, and for one of them, they found that there was a positive correlation, and that correlation resulted in a odds ratio of 1.14 to 2.10, meaning that there's roughly a 1.5 percentage chance of having ADHD if you have higher concentrations of this metabolite in your urine. And then they looked at those kids with the highest, a tenfold increase in this certain types of metabolites, and they had on average about a twice as high a incidence of ADHD, although the range is 1.23 to 3.02. You know, with 95% confidence. So there was some increased association, and of course the media is reporting this as if it's a done deal, right? As if this is a definitive study showing, you know, pesticides linked to ADHD. Putting this into context, it's a lot more tricky than that. You know, first of all, if you look at the range of possible, you know, ratios, they get awfully close to one. So at the lower end of the confidence interval, it's not that high a risk. Much of an increase in risk, meaning that, you know, because this is not a prospective or experimental study, this is just a retrospective observational study, even slight biases in the way the information is recorded or collected could account for that. One thing that the authors themselves noted in just going over the weaknesses of the study is that, you know, this is just a one-time spot urine. And organophosphates are cleared from the body in 3 to 6 days. So this doesn't really tell us anything about long-term exposure to organophosphates, just at the time that the urine was done, you know, how much recent exposure they had. Because it's correlational, again, you know, correlation does not equal causation, so we cannot assume that the only possible explanation is that organophosphates cause ADHD. It's possible and not implausible that children who have ADHD may engage in behaviors that put them at higher exposure to organophosphates, for example. This is far from a definitive study. This is the kind of study, and if you read what the authors actually conclude in the article, this is the kind of study where you can conclude that this deserves further research. We need to do further studies where we do longitudinal urinalysis for organophosphates to see what the long-term exposure is, where we do more accurate diagnosis, not just a phone interview, and we try to you know, look at the data in different ways to see if the correlation holds up before we could really see what this means. Some people have brought up the fact, for example, that if organophosphates were a significant contributor to ADHD, then we should be able to see other correlations. So in areas or countries where there's more organophosphates, we should be seeing more ADHD. The EPA significantly reduced the amount of exposure to organophosphates, the amount of safe levels, about 5 years ago, and we haven't started to see any trailing off of ADHD, which you might predict would happen if it were, again, were a significant contributor to it. So, again, this is far from definitive, and we need to do a lot of follow-up research. Now, of course, when the authors are being interviewed by the press, they're not constrained by peer review. So this is always interesting. When you submit an article for peer review, You can't really make conclusions that go beyond the data. And therefore, the authors, the scientists, are very circumspect. You know, they're very, very careful. And they may have actually even gotten feedback saying, you know, to rein in their conclusions so that they don't go beyond the data. But then once they're outside of the constraints of the peer review process and they're in front of the media, then they're more open and they say things that really do go far beyond the data, like that we have to like seriously consider, you know, ways of reducing, you know, the use of this pesticide or even you know, the promoters of organic farming were all over this, just saying that this means everybody should be eating organic, right? Because there's fewer pesticides with organic produce. But you really can't conclude that from this study. All you could really conclude is that there's a correlation and it should be further researched. I think the only thing you could say that's really reasonable is that given that our data right now is imperfect, you know, the EPA has to decide how to incorporate this into their regulations about safety limits of organophosphates, and they may decide to dial it back based upon this data. I think for the average consumer, just, you know, routinely washing your fruits and vegetables is probably adequate. There actually is evidence that shows that significantly reduces any residual pesticides. You know, that would reduce the levels to the degree that, you know, they wouldn't produce any significant exposure like the kinds that were seen in this study. But also, you know, the very reasonable fear is that children will be given and will eat fewer fruits and vegetables, which could have a far greater adverse health consequence than any small amounts of residual pesticides do. It's one of those things where, you know, you might mean well, but the unintended consequences could actually be, you know, worse than what it is you're trying to avoid, especially when the data is ambiguous and we don't really know what the risk is. So I think the zero risk thing to do is just to wash your fruits and vegetables. Well, let's go on to Who's That Noisy? Evan, can you play Who's That Noisy from last week?
Yeah, I can. Let's replay, as Steve says, last week's Who's That Noisy? All right. Now, that was a hard one, to say the least.
There wasn't much to go on there.
No, there really wasn't, although I did
tried Googling that, but I didn't get anything.
It's some kind of electronic noise.
How'd you spell that, Rebecca?
I gave... a bunch of Z's and some T's in there. I gave a hint that for those who were paying attention to their science and technical articles from the past 6 weeks or so might have come across this actual noisy as part of that article, which is where I pulled it from.
God.
And this was back on April 16th, 2010, from symmetrymagazine.org. Bob, are you familiar with that?
Yeah.
This is a Fermilab publication entitled Dark Matter, Can You Hear Me Now? Isn't that cool? So they've been able to isolate and capture the noise that effectively dark matter makes inside this container.
What?
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it's amazing.
That's the sound of dark matter?
Yep, they found a way to use sound to tune in dark matter passing through an underground bubble chamber, and they tuned out the what they call imposter particles. And what they were left with? Dark matter.
That's awesome.
Wow.
Wow.
I've got to read about that. That's
did anybody get that?
A hard time.
Nobody got that.
Nobody got it.
No, one got it. It was very hard. A lot of people thought it had something to do with the oil pipeline break in the Gulf, and that's what most people were going for.
I saw some Saturn's rings and some other things in there.
Yeah, a few others from recent. So,
try to give them an easier one this time, Evan.
Yeah, I think I came up with a much easier one. At least I think it's a much easier All right. one for this week. Here is this week's Who's That Noisy?
But I've been running scared about a heart attack since I'm 30, maybe 20, which is what drove me into the jungles of the South Seas collecting plants, drove me to get a PhD in epidemiology and nutrition, drove me to research and write books on health before I went into radio.
I imagine a few folks will recognize that voice, but let's see. Let's see how you do. Give it your best guess. Good luck, everyone.
I think somebody will get that right this week.
I think so.
Well, let's go on to a couple of your emails and questions. We had a number of questions about liquid mountaineering.
Oh, yeah.
Despite the fact that Rebecca had already blogged about it, So, Rebecca...
Yeah, can you people... You people have to do me a favor, and you have to read Skeptic, okay? That's all I ask. It's not asking much.
Right?
You have to read all of our blogs before you email us.
Yes. All of them.
Please, somebody read
mine. So, you telling me that people cannot walk on water?
That's... No, I would never tell you that. I'm telling you that... I'm going to go ahead and tell you that.
I saw Chris Angel do it on a TV show once.
All right, give us the scoop here. What's going on?
Okay. Well, first of all, people should not feel bad that they fell for this, I guess, because they're not alone. There are literally dozens of other SGU listeners who also fell for this. It was a YouTube video that showed a group of guys in Portugal who were at a lake, and they were talking about a new sport they came up with, liquid mountaineering. And all they had to do was run fast enough over the water, and they would somehow stay on the surface of the water for about a dozen steps before falling in. And they said that what really helped is if they wear a specific kind of waterproof shoe. So people sent this to us in droves. And so my post on Skeptic was basically a breakdown of what to look for when you suspect that a video might not be on the up and up. And this one had a number of points going against it. For instance, one point is that all the men in the video are wearing the same brand from head to toe, a brand called High Tech. Another one is them talking about the specific running shoe that was waterproof. How does that even help you run on water if it floated? Okay. But no, not waterproof. Another fact is that the guys in it, I thought, were rather attractive. All of them very good-looking, model-y types. A bit weird. Another point, the filming is gorgeous. It's clearly... A lot of money was spent on this.
Yeah, it's produced.
Yeah.
Along with licensed music, so that would cost a pretty penny as well. So, you know, you have to wonder who paid for this.
Yeah.
There's another one. You know, if somebody breaks the laws of physics, that's another kind of...
Oh, that.
Okay.
Another is that they use jet skis to increase their land speed before they hit the water. Tell me, would, you know, grabbing a hold of a truck while you're running, would that make you run faster, or would it just drag you along into your bloody pulp? That doesn't actually make you go faster. And finally, they're breaking the laws of physics. You cannot run across a freshwater lake that is not frozen, unless you've taken the time to put a structure just underneath the surface of the lake that allows your actors to run across all in the same exact pattern.
What are you insinuating there, Rebecca Watson?
I'm insinuating that this was, in fact, a viral advertisement for high-tech sporting goods. And that's not to say, just because I'm pointing out all of these things and saying that this is quite obviously a viral ad.
And now we're a tool of the viral ad campaign.
I'll admit that it's a good one. It's fun to watch.
Yeah.
It's very beautifully filmed.
Yeah.
It's well done. But it is, in fact, a viral. So please, you know, if you look at things like this, do send them in, because we like seeing this stuff and we like to know what's going on. But just for your own sake, there were a number of people, like more than five of you, I'd say, at this point, who wrote in and said, I saw this video and I Googled about it for a bit, but I couldn't really find anything. Seems like it's on the up and up. You're not using Google right. So I wanted to just give you guys this tip. If you come across something like this, seems a little suspicious, don't just Google liquid mountaineering and go to the first three websites that pop up. What you do is Google liquid mountaineering fake, or liquid mountaineering viral.
Hoax.
Or hoax, yeah. Or even if it's something that's been around a long time, I find that it's helpful to Google liquid mountaineering skeptic.
Yeah, that's what I do.
Because that'll lead you to skeptical sites that have already debunked it. And if you do that, or in fact, if you just Google liquid mountaineering and go to the last link on the first page, which is labeled something like liquid mountaineering fake, you'll see that other people have already gone to the trouble to debunk the ever-loving hell out of this.
Yeah.
So, you know, just a little tip there, a little Google tip for you. But do, you know, my blog post and this particular report may come across a bit snarky, but we do love hearing from you, even when it's something we've gotten a lot.
Yeah, though, please send us stuff. Yeah, it just gives us more meat for the show. I also would point out that the Mythbusters kind of covered this topic. It was on their ninja special, and it was just, could ninjas walk over water, you know, with the right kinds of shoes? And they tried to build, you know, the platforms under their feet that would support their weight by distributing their weight, and it was hopeless. There just was no way to do it. Yeah, it was just total failure. Well, thanks for that, Rebecca. Let's go on to the next question. This one comes from Jacob, who writes, "Big fan, et cetera, but I often hear, see you use the term cult. Could you give me a definition of what a cult is? Specifically, could you provide one that distinguishes a cult from, say, a Baptist church, a Buddhist society, while also being encompassing enough to include all of the different groups that people have applied the labeled cult to? I ask because I do not have such a definition, and from everything that I know about the sociology of religions, it is not possible to have such a definition. Cult seems to be a derogatory term applied by members of a dominant popular religious group towards a smaller religious group that they don't like, and I'm disappointed that you use it so readily and without any qualification. I know you're very busy, but I hope you find time to respond."
Nope, we have no time to respond to this.
Yep, sorry.
Yeah, moving on.
Sorry, moving on.
Next question segment.
So
poor listener, poor Jacob.
I know we've talked about this before. So, you know, it's one of those things where we can't define the term cult every time it comes up in an episode. You know, we can't go into the 5-minute side discussion. We also talk about grand conspiracies, and we can't really define it every time. Is it so that, you know, sometimes we have to rely upon discussions that we've had previously? But I think it's been a while since we've spoken about it. So actually, I did write a blog entry about this on Neurologica, and I thought we can go over it briefly. I disagree with Jacob in the notion that we cannot come up with a definition of a cult. In fact, many people have come up with definitions of cult, but they are comprised of a list of characteristics. And, you know, cult is, again, is one of those things where... it's fuzzy. You have to avoid the false dichotomy, right? There aren't just something which is purely 100% a cult and other things that are not at all a cult. It's a spectrum.
Some things could be culty.
Yeah, you could be a little bit cult-like.
Cultish, that would be the
kind of in the middle, or like a full-fledged cult. You could be anywhere along that spectrum. So there are certain features that we might talk about include things like being totalitarian, where the cult leader and the leaders have absolute authority and even, you know, in many ways, total control over the cult members.
Or when the leader forces members to disconnect from family members or anybody who's not in that that group.
Yeah, so that's another feature, separation. Yeah, they try to inculcate in us versus them. Or in-group versus out-group type of mentality, cut members off from their former family support, you know, social support structures, etc. They may also make the members dependent upon the cult by taking all their money, basically. Secrecy. Cults are not upfront with their full belief systems. You know, so like we talked about Scientology, the fact that, you know, they don't come right out and tell you about Xenu. You have to work your way into the, you know, inner folds of the cult before you learn what the real beliefs are, as opposed to, say, the Catholic Church, which is very completely open about what their beliefs are. They don't hide them. It's not like only the priests know what, you know, Catholicism is really about. And then there's
maybe they do, and we just don't know.
That's true. That's true. And they've been really good about it.
They're experts.
I'm reminded of a South Park episode.
the giant mother spider.
Yeah,
they use various techniques of manipulation and mind control to, you know, sometimes quite deliberate For example, there's a common technique known as love bombing, where they will overwhelm recruits or prospective members with physical and psychological positive attention. This is especially effective against people who are vulnerable, who feel isolated or depressed, for example. They will use guilt. They use hypnosis techniques. Remember I talked recently about the surrendering of your critical thinking to a charismatic leader through, you know, hypnosis. They will actively use that. Loss of privacy, deprivation, verbal abuse, and many other techniques. And they tend to have a self-contained belief system that is circular and non-falsifiable, right? So once you get inside the belief system, it's completely self-contained. And also, you know, it contains answers to all, you know, possible questions. They, you know, actively discourage questioning, and they will also denigrate anyone who tries to leave the group or who questions the group or its leaders. So there's others, but those, I looked over about a dozen or so different schemes of defining a cult, and those seem to be the most common themes that cropped up in all of them. So the more of those features, you know, a belief system or institution or group has, the more cult-like it is. It's like a lot of other things. You know, I talked about this being the cult demarcation problem, right? We talked about the demarcation problem between science and pseudoscience. It's the same thing. You come up with a list of features of pseudoscience, and, you know, the more of those you have, the more pseudoscientific you are. So it's just one of those systems where there's a spectrum and you're somewhere along the spectrum. But when we use the term, you know, we're basically saying you have enough of those features where it's reasonable to put you at that, the cult end of the spectrum. Doesn't mean you have every feature. But I do find that a lot of critics of religion like to conflate the two, you know, to say, well, in fact, I wrote my blog about it, and in the comments to that blog, as if the guy didn't even read what I wrote, one of the commenters wrote, "It's easy way to differentiate cult, a small, unpopular religion, a large, popular cult." Very pithy, but goes against everything that I wrote in my blog entry about the fact that the key difference actually is, and I think this is where people get confused. I actually have a very interesting anecdote about this, which I'll tell you first. About 10 years ago, Perry and I were involved with a cult awareness group. It was actually the Leo J. Ryan Society, which was the successor to the Cult Awareness Network, which was taken over by Scientology. Yeah. And the
the irony.
Really.
They
sued them out of existence and actually took ownership over the name and everything. It's terrible. So since that point, like if a distraught parent whose child was taken up by a terrible cult calls the Cult Awareness Network, they get a Scientologist on the other end.
Right.
But anyway, the Leo J. Ryan Society was having their first conference, and you know, we knew some people who were involved in that organization. They asked us to co-sponsor it with them and to put on a seminar on skepticism and critical thinking. And you know, we kind of sold it as a way of like a defense mechanism against cults, and they really liked that notion that, you know, critical thinking was a defense mechanism. And at our suggestion, they got as their keynote speaker James Randi.
Hey.
Yeah, and he was awesome. You know, he was his charming self. He had a magic seminar, you know, that we attended, you know, earlier in the conference, and it was awesome. And then his keynote speech was, you know, Randi has a large number of lectures that he gives, and it was I can't remember actually which one it was, but it was, you know, one of his standard lectures. I don't think I had heard it before, and it was wonderful. But at the end of his keynote speech at a cult conference, Randi essentially made the same observation that there's no difference between the belief system of religions and the belief systems of what are called cults, which was kind of a cringing moment because, and I think it's just, you know, I don't think that at the time Randi was familiar with, you know, the cult literature, if you will. The point that he was missing and the point that the commenter is missing is that what defines a cult is not what they believe at all. It's how they behave. The belief system is almost incidental. In fact, there could be self-help cults, there could be investment cults, medical cults, paramilitary or survivalist cults. They don't even have to be religious. There are UFO cults. The belief system itself, while there are certain beliefs which sort of are insular and lend themselves to cult-like behavior, it's really incidental to it. So Randy was right, but it was irrelevant. That, yes, believing in parting the Red Seas and rising from the dead, these are magical beliefs and no different than the magical beliefs of the cults that they were talking about at this conference, but that's not the point. The point was the totalitarian, abusive behavior, isolating behavior of the cults. That's what makes them a cult. But we actually got into that discussion in the comment, in the question and comment section, after Randy's speech. And I think by the end of the conference, Randy got it. And in fact, he waived his fee for the speech just to help out the organization. I think he felt a little bad about his talk. But he was really cool about it. And it was a good opportunity, actually, to explore that issue. Because actually, I think that the cult awareness community doesn't always quite get that either. And interestingly, a lot of people who are ex-cult members, when they come out of the cult, either part of the process of coming out of the cult or after leaving the cult, became very active in a more mainstream religion, right? And part of their criticism of the cult is that, for example, it's not real Christianity, right? Now they're have a real belief system. So they kind of focus on the belief system, which I think is missing the point about the behavior. One other interesting aside that I thought was kind of amusing was a couple of people after Randy's talk noted that they had a very negative reaction to Randy because of his charisma, because he's a very confident, charismatic public speaker. And it gave them a total post-traumatic stress kind of flashback to their cult leader.
Ouch.
So they kind of had that reaction to him because, that's the kind of personality. And in fact,
you're saying Randy's a cult leader.
I think Randy has the perfect personality for a cult leader. And in fact, Randy, in his own lecture at the cult conference, was talking about the fact that magic is 90% about your persona. Right? Mm. It's about, like somebody asked him, because he was explaining some of his tricks, I remember. He was explaining a card trick, and it was a trick deck. And somebody asked, what if somebody asks to look at the deck? And Randy replied, they won't ask. If they ask, you have failed. You have already failed. The prestidigitation, the handwork, that's not the magic trick. The magic trick is your persona. It's how you psychologically manipulate the audience. And the bottom line is they won't ask. I think what Randy was saying is that as a magician, you use a lot of the same kind of manipulative techniques that cult leaders use. But of course, they're using it in a very nefarious way to manipulate people into their clutches as opposed to using it for entertainment, right? But Randy still gave off that vibe that these cult survivors totally saw and reacted to emotionally, which I thought was very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is interesting.
Bob, before we go on to science or fiction, I want you to tell us your crazy skeptical headline of the week.
Yeah, this is one of those headlines that you just got to kind of read like three times. It's like, what? Oh, my God. This one was great. The title is, Witch Claims That the Loch Ness Monster is Actually a Ghost. I mean, it just says it all. It's the trifecta of paranormal news article titles. It's like, wow. Okay, what else can you throw in there? That was awesome.
That's wonderful.
I didn't even read the article. I just love the title.
It's like an Onion article.
What was it? Psychic Alien Big Feet? Was that the other?
Yeah, right.
Psychic Alien Big Feet. There was a book on that or something?
Right.
How much pseudoscience can you cram into one discussion?
Yeah, that's like my psychic numerologist, astrologer.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Gotta love it.
Awesome.
All right, well, let's go on to science or fiction.
It's time for science. Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Is everyone ready?
Yep.
So ready.
All right, let's get down to it. Item number one, a new study shows that wild birds prefer conventionally grown seeds to their organically grown counterparts. Item number two, a recent review concludes that epidemiological and animal data support the conclusion that caffeine slows progression and improves function in Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. And item number three, researchers announced that they have successfully developed a universal flu vaccine that can be widely available prior to the next flu season. Bob, go first.
Birds prefer conventionally grown seeds to their organically grown counterparts. It kind of makes sense that they would prefer regular seeds, but the other, there's also the part of, can they really tell the difference between the seeds? I mean, they're essentially the same damn thing with just minor genetic differences, and they're going to tell the difference? Crap. Let's see, the second one here. Epidemiological and animal data support the conclusion that caffeine slows progression and improves function in Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. I could kind of, on the surface kind of makes sense. You know, caffeine can make you for a little while anyway, I guess, a little bit more alert, able to focus. Let's see, they've researchers have successfully developed a universal flu vaccine. What? Universal flu vaccine, yeah. That can be widely available prior to the next flu season. Well, that's just baloney. How could a universal flu vaccine? They've got to be tailored. Every season they've got to be tailored to the flus that have been prevalent prior to that. They do a study on what flus are kind of up and coming. You know, what combinations of things can they throw in there? But that's just too obvious. I'm going to say, I'll say the birds. Birds fiction.
Okay, Rebecca?
I think the bird one makes sense because I can see that
bird sense.
Yes, bird sense. I can imagine that there's a difference between the seeds that would be noticeable to the birds, either in taste or probably nutrition. And I also do believe that caffeine slows the progression of Alzheimer's, only because I find the flu vaccine one so bizarre. The flu changes from year to year, and I can't imagine coming up with a universal vaccine. It would be awesome, and it would save lots of lives, I imagine, but I don't think that one's true. So I'm going to say, yeah, flu vaccine is BS.
Okay, Evan?
The one about the seeds, I wonder if the difference there between conventionally and organically grown counterparts is perhaps conventionally grown, or naturally grown. Maybe they have very small traces of bacteria or something that occur in nature that you don't get if you organically grow it. Something microscopic along those lines could be the difference between the two. So I'm gonna suggest that one is science. And caffeine slowing the progression and improving the function in Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. I'm leaning towards that being science as well. I think I regularly see news articles about caffeine, and there's tremendous amounts of research, at least, and therefore, this universal flu vaccine. My initial thought was, well, maybe they developed it, but it's not very effective. maybe it has yes, they can develop it, but maybe it comes at, a less effective percentage. However, I do have to choose one of these as fiction, so I'm going to say the flu vaccine one is fiction.
All right, so you all agree that a recent review concludes that epidemiological and animal data support the conclusion that caffeine slows progression and improves function in Alzheimer's disease and other ailment in other dementias, and that one is science. That's actually a little surprising.
Hooray for coffee.
Yeah, that caffeine may have this benefit, but just to be clear, this again is epidemiological and animal data, not clinical data. So essentially they're saying is this justifies going on to definitive clinical trials. So that's basically the next stage, which still means it'll be 5 years or more before we know what the net clinical effect is. But, you know, caffeine seems to have a neuroprotective effect, perhaps, in the brain. It may go beyond just its stimulant effect. The stimulant effect actually goes away after you get tolerant to that very quickly after a few weeks.
Yeah, that's true.
So I don't really think it has to do with that. It must be doing something else. So they say that the key findings based upon the existing data for caffeine include multiple beneficial effects of caffeine to normalize brain function and prevent degeneration, caffeine's neuroprotective profile and its ability to reduce amyloid beta production, is a candidate disease-modifying agent for Alzheimer's disease, positive impact of caffeine on cognition and memory performance, identification of adenosine A2A receptors as the main target for neuroprotection afforded by caffeine consumption, and epidemiological studies corroborated by meta-analysis suggesting that caffeine may be protective against Parkinson's disease as well. So there are probably some novel targets that caffeine is binding to that that is giving it its neuroprotective effect. If this basic science is correct, this may lead to more fine-tuned drug development if we could, you know, really hone in on that. But also, since caffeine is so widely available, it'd be nice to know if it just by itself can have a clinically relevant effect in things like Alzheimer's disease. So definitely need to do some clinical studies. Let's go on to item number one. A new study shows that wild birds prefer conventionally grown seeds to their organically grown counterparts. Bob, you thought that one was the fiction. And that one is science.
Ah!
Yay!
Sorry, Bob.
Uh-huh.
So Rebecca was correct.
You should have thought about it a bit longer, Bob.
Rebecca was correct in figuring out how the birds differentiate. So, Bob, you mentioned something about there being a genetic difference, but there isn't. This is not genetic.
Yeah, you know why?
Modified.
I read organic, and in my head, I heard genetically modified.
I just want to clarify that. This wasn't genetically modified. This is just the same seeds, exactly the same seeds, either just grown conventionally or organically. And what they did is a two-year study. They would set out bins with wheat seeds, et cetera, side by side, and then measure, how much the birds were eating. And the birds preferred the conventionally grown seed. They ate more of it. And then for the following year, they swapped them just to make sure there was no preference for what the physical positioning was. And the birds learned that the other one now had the good seed in it, and they switched over to eating, from the other side. So they preferred the conventionally grown seed. And the reason, almost, very, very likely, is that conventionally grown seeds have, on average, 10% higher protein content than the organic seeds. So the birds were going for the higher protein content, which is essential, for them to live through a lean winter. Getting that extra protein, extra calories is critical for their survival. The authors say that, this again, it means this is evidence that we have to think very carefully about, organically grown produce, that and that the reason for the increased protein content is probably because of the nitrogen-based fertilizers that are used in conventionally grown food, that yields higher protein content. So not only is there no evidence for organically grown food having better nutritional value, it may in fact in some cases have less nutritional value than conventionally grown food.
If you're a bird.
Right. Which means that researchers announced that they have successfully developed a universal flu vaccine that can be widely available prior to the next flu season is just barely fiction.
Just barely.
But it's
barely
more true than any of you seem to have guessed. I really was debating about whether or not to make this one a real one. I probably should have. But the problem is it's not – they haven't developed a universal flu vaccine. They've just made a breakthrough in the development of a universal flu vaccine. So I always find those tricky. And they're certainly not going to be ready by next flu season. This is still going to be years in development. They're only at the animal testing stage. But the concept of a universal flu vaccine is not far-fetched. The reason that we have to come up with a new flu vaccine every season is because the flu vaccines are targeting parts of the flu virus that are highly variable. the specifically the hemagglutinin, which is, you know, if like, yeah, when you have the designation like H1N1, the H is stands for hemagglutinin, and that's a very, very variable region, and therefore, you know, different strains will be different enough that the previous vaccine against the previous strain won't really react to it very much.
So they're variable, Steve, but they're variable, I assume then, that they're also the most vulnerable spots, the easiest spots to...
Yeah, exactly. Otherwise, they wouldn't, you know, target the most variable region if they didn't have to. But, you know, viruses have more conserved regions as well, right? So there are places on the coat of the virus that do not vary as much. If we could figure out how to target a vaccine antibody against a highly conserved portion of the influenza virus, that could theoretically then create a universal influenza vaccine. So what these researchers did is they essentially lopped the head off of a hemagglutinin molecule. The head is where the real variable region is, where the stalk, if you will, is the more conserved region. And they then immunized with this truncated hemagglutinin, and that created antibodies, which then were widely cross-reactive with other strains of influenza. They also showed that the research demonstrating the possibility of protecting against all influenza A virus types or even phylogenetically distant pathogens, which with vaccines based on highly conserved peptide or saccharide sequences. So that's the goal. And they were able to demonstrate immunity in the rats that they were studying this on. So this is a very important breakthrough, but it's still just one step. In the mice that they were doing. So the mice that they immunized developed a good immune response. We may see in 5 or 10 years, you know, you get one flu vaccine and it's good against all strains of the flu for 10 or 20 years or something, and then you just need to get a booster every now and then, probably something like that. And also, if we get taken by surprise by a flu epidemic or pandemic, if people have already been immunized with the universal flu vaccine, they'll be covered, right?
Cool.
Yeah. So Jay is not with us this week. So I decided to cover the quote for this week. I'm pretty sure we haven't done this one. This is a quote from Percival Lowell, who lived from 1855 to 1916. Percival Lowell was an astronomer, founded the Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona, where Jay is. Arizona, that is. He also began the effort to find Pluto, although it wasn't discovered until after his death. The name Pluto, in fact, is partly an homage to Percival Lowell, in that the PL is right. It's his initials. And he's also famous for investigating and claiming to have possibly found canals on Mars, which turned out
The canals of Mars.
Yeah, to be just an optical illusion. But Percival Lowell is quoted as saying, "Imagination is as vital to any advance in science as learning and precision are essential for starting points." Percival Lowell.
Damn right.
To the voice.
Yep.
PL.
PL. Now, I'm not going to step on Jay's toes. I'll leave that for him.
Pluto.
I have an announcement.
Yeah.
The Skeptic Party is on.
Oh, yeah.
If you go to Skeptic.
Where? When?
It's going to be at the Amazing Meeting in Las Vegas on the Saturday. I think that's July 10th. And all the information you need is on skeptic.org. You have to get on a list, and it's going to be epic. We have an enormous desert villa log cabin thing. It's going to be an Old West theme, and there will be a costume party. So
you have to come in costume?
But there'll be a contest. It's recommended. A contest with prizes.
Awesome.
Yes, chaps are recommended.
What kind of prizes?
And my spurs. Cowboy prizes.
It's going to be a collection of skeptical goods. More information closer to the party.
So that's Saturday night at TAM. And, of course, remember that Friday night at TAM is the SGU dinner. You can register for the dinner on the JREF registration page. If you've already registered, just go back and register separately for the dinner. If you haven't signed up for TAM yet, go ahead and don't forget to also sign up for the dinner. It's going to be a lot of fun. We're all going to be there.
Absolutely.
As well as many of our skeptical friends. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Surely.
Thank you, Doctor. Steve. We miss you, Jay.
Yeah, we miss you, Jay. We'll see you next week.
Evan misses you. Just kidding.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and Skeptchick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.